This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. Each night, we're here to answer your questions.
My name is Melissa, and I live in Alexandria, Virginia.
My name is Sushma.
My name is Julie Hall.
Paul Hanrahan. I live in Milwaukee, Oregon.
I'm actually a retired public health nurse.
Since I'm in my 50s, this is particularly worrying.
You know, I have not heard anybody ask this question.
My question is,
do you have any ideas for quick, easy, family-friendly lunches and breakfasts?
We need a vaccine in 3 months, not 18. How do we make that happen?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tonight, we have NPR journalists and outside experts on hand to offer you solid facts, tell you what we know, and correct some of the misinformation that's floating around. And when we don't know something, we will tell you that, too. Send us your questions about the pandemic and the way we live now at npr.org/nationalconversation. On Twitter, use the hashtag NPRConversation. Each night, we begin the National Conversation by answering the question, what happened today? Well, today, the global death toll from the coronavirus has passed 100,000. In New York City, workers began digging mass graves on Hart Island off the coast of the Bronx. But for the first time in New York, there was a drop in new hospitalizations. Dr. Deborah Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force says while there are encouraging signs, we have not hit the peak yet.
Every day, we need to continue to do what we did yesterday and the week before and the week before that.
Also at the White House briefing, Surgeon General Jerome Adams pulled out his inhaler.
I've been carrying around an inhaler in my pocket for 40 years out of fear of having a fatal asthma attack.
He made a personal appeal to African Americans who data show are disproportionately affected by the coronavirus.
The chronic burden of medical ills is likely to make people of color, especially, less resilient to the ravages of COVID-19.
In Los Angeles, starting today, you have to wear a mask to go out. Mayor Eric Garcetti says if you don't, stores can refuse to serve you.
We now wanted to make sure that that was mandated, that employers knew that they had a responsibility, that employees knew that they had a protection.
President Trump said he would celebrate Easter watching a service on a laptop, and he urged people not to gather for services.
Let's get healed before we do this. And this time to do that, we'll do it for hopefully the rest of our lives.
In France, just 7 people were allowed to attend a Good Friday service inside the rubble of the Notre Dame Cathedral nearly a year after the fire there. The Archbishop of Paris, wearing a mask and a hard hat, said they held the mass to say that life continues. And a small study released today showed improvement in COVID-19 patients who were given the experimental antiviral drug remdesivir. Joining us now is NPR science correspondent John Hamilton. Good to have you back, John.
Glad to be here.
Did I pronounce that drug correctly?
Remdesivir, yes.
Okay, great. Well, let's dive in with our listeners' questions. This first one speaks about that new study. Bobby in Portland, Oregon, has this question about possible therapies for COVID-19.
I wondered why there's not more reporting about the many companies, small and large, that are working on therapeutic drugs and vaccines and have started trials to determine efficacy and safety.
Lots of research going on all over the world. Tell us about this latest study.
Well, you know, as you said, it involves this drug, remdesivir, and it's an antiviral drug. It was originally tried as a treatment for Ebola, and the results of this new study, they're somewhat encouraging, but really preliminary. So the study looked at about 50 patients. They were really sick. More than half were on ventilators, and everybody in the study got the drug, so there was no control group. Mm-hmm. About 2/3 of them, though, got better, though the rest didn't, and unfortunately, 7 people died.
Hmm. Does this mean that doctors might start prescribing this drug to patients with severe cases of COVID-19, or is the study too small for that?
They're not ready for that yet. This was not the sort of rigorous trial you would submit to the FDA to get a drug approved, and 50 people is not a lot. And as I said, there was no control group. So it's really hard to know what would have happened to these patients if they had not received the drug. Now, fortunately, there are some much more rigorous studies underway that should tell us a lot more about how well this drug works. And you cannot, as I said, get this drug from your doctor, but there are some medical centers that are authorized to give it for emergency use. Hmm. So depending on where you are, it might be an option if you get really sick.
That question also mentioned vaccines, which we're going to be talking about a lot in another part of the program. So let's go on to this next question. I know, John, you've done a lot of reporting about exercising, and we keep getting questions about it. Let's listen to this one from Daniel in Melbourne, Florida.
Before the outbreak occurred, I had been training for a triathlon. Events have since been postponed. I've been doing my best to continue training since, for me, it's a pretty socially distanced activity. Now that Florida is under a stay-at-home order, am I still able to run and bike for exercise and continued training?
Okay, so triathlon, running, biking, swimming. John, I'm not going to ask you to rank those in terms of which is safer during the pandemic, but how safe is it, and is it allowed under stay-at-home orders to go out in public running and bicycling?
Well, every stay-at-home order is different, but I'm pretty sure that Daniel can go right on training. I can understand why he's confused, because Florida is one of the states that has imposed, you know, one of these stay-at-home orders, and like a lot of the orders, it's really not that clear about precisely what you can and can't do. So, for example, the Florida order says you can only leave your home to conduct, quote, essential activities. Mm-hmm. And that phrase caused so much confusion that the governor actually issued a clarification. So it turns out essential activities includes running, swimming, and biking, right? I think that covers everything you do in a triathlon.
Yeah, I know that here in Washington, D.C., where we are, the stay-at-home order explicitly says exercise is permitted. Here's another question that we got from Damaris in Little Falls, New Jersey.
I have a 10-year-old son with asthma, and I also have a 6-month-old son. And I would like to know, what are the effects of COVID-19 on children with asthma and the effects of this virus on 6-month-old children or just infants in general?
This is tricky because we've heard that the COVID-19 tends to be less severe in young kids, more severe in people with asthma. So when you have a young kid with asthma, John, what does the data show?
Right. I mean, even infants seem to do pretty well. Many don't even develop a fever. But there definitely is reason to be concerned about a child with asthma. As the Surgeon General reminded us today, it is one of the underlying conditions that, you know, tends to make coronavirus infection more dangerous. And I looked in a couple of days ago, actually, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published a study. It looked at about 300 kids who got COVID-19. And most kids, of course, did far better than older adults who got the virus. But one of the interesting things I saw was that most of the kids who end up in the hospital had at least one underlying health condition. This is similar to adults. The difference was that the most common condition among kids was asthma. So asthma is a problem. Also, it can make it harder to detect pneumonia, which is, of course, the most dangerous thing that can happen with coronavirus. And the reason is that both asthma and pneumonia can affect lung function. So it's probably a child with asthma should be extra careful, and a parent really should be looking for early signs of illness.
Okay, looks like Damaris should take extra caution with that child. Let's take this question from Janet, who's in Northern California.
I'm calling because I'm worried about people during this COVID epidemic who have substance use disorder. Loneliness, boredom, and stress are all triggers for relapses, but Zoom meetings just can't be enough. If there's no in-person contact, no drug testing, or other accountability, and a lot of the treatment programs are closed, is there anything else available? Thanks.
John, I think this question hits close to home for a lot of people. Recovery is challenging under the best of circumstances. What would you say to Janet?
I wish I had a great answer. Obviously, stress and uncertainty of a pandemic doesn't exactly make recovery any easier. And I know some organizations for people with substance use disorder have reported, you know, anecdotally that they're hearing about more relapses, but there's not great data. Mm-hmm. One thing that is clear is that, you know, for many people in, say, 12-step programs, this opportunity to actually go to a specific place each day and be in the same room with other people with similar experiences is really important. And of course, now that's not permitted in a lot of areas, and obviously a Zoom meeting isn't going to replace that. I know that some chapters of Alcoholics Anonymous have set up digital meetings, and the national website has a guide for setting up these meetings.
This also seems like a situation where leaning on a sponsor can be all the more important. If you have a question for John
Hamilton, even if you can't see them in person.
Yeah, yeah, even if it's just a FaceTime or a phone call. If you have questions for John Hamilton, send them to us at npr.org/nationalconversation, or on Twitter you can ask using the hashtag NPRConversation. Now, John, we have this question from Eric in Berkeley, California.
My question is just whether facial hair is good or bad. I mean, does the virus get stuck in the hair, or is it better to, you know, have it smooth, or is it worse to have it smooth? I was also curious to know if once someone is infected, are they still possible to spread it, or are they immune to it?
Now, John, we've only got about a minute left, and we have answered the immunity question before, so let me just ask you to tackle the facial hair question.
Let's tackle facial hair. I have heard no evidence that having a beard puts you at risk for coronavirus, even those ironic beards I've been hearing about.
And so many people are growing them in isolation.
Right. I mean, what else are you going to do? It's probably a good idea to wash your beard if you wash your face and hands. So I think that's probably a good. And then you mentioned the CDC guidance on facial hair and masks. That is a real issue. And the bottom line is you can probably skate by with a mustache or a soul patch, but a full beard is going to interfere with a mask's ability to seal stuff out.
All right. NPR science correspondent John Hamilton, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
And you can hear much more of our coverage when you download the NPR One app. Go to the Explore tab and click on the coronavirus outbreak for a curated stream of stories. Up next, answers to your questions about how the virus is impacting climate change. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.